Let's begin with a question. Do you remember what Karl Marx said about religion? He was a deeply compassionate man, this patron saint of communism, and he had pitied the poor and the homeless, and he had decided that if it were not for the restraint of religion and the promise to those people of pie in the sky, by and by, they would angrily revolt. So religion, he decided, is the opiate of the people, a sweet-smelling and pleasant drug by which those who are well off are confirmed in their conviction that God has recognized their merit, and the wretched poor are anesthetized to their misery on the grounds that life is short anyway, and if they behave, they will soon be in heaven. Marx's criticism fascinates college students when they come to it. And this remark by a student is typical. Religion is nothing but a chloroform mask into which the weak and the unhappy stick their faces. So how does one respond? I suppose the first thing to do is admit the amount of truth in those comments. Highly intelligent people do not bring such criticisms against religion unless there is some truth in them. The attitude those critics hold in contempt is perfectly expressed by a poor woman in Robert Lynn's Middletown when she says, "Land sakes, I don't see how people live at all who don't cheer themselves up by thinking of God and heaven." And right there, our critics say, you have the origin of religion, a buffer against harsh reality, a kind of pleasant fairyland into which frightened people take refuge. But that is not at all a biblical notion. Moses, Jacob, who gave Israel its name, Job, the defiant heretic, these great heroes of Jewish scripture all wrestled with God very angrily at times and fought with fate and had no easy time of it at all. The kind of religion described in the Bible is not primarily comfortable and pleasant. It holds out the promise of creating great character, but it makes no bones about being an obstacle to much of what the world calls success. Jesus himself, who might have enjoyed a quiet life in the hill town of Nazareth, fishing once a week in the clear water of Lake Galilee, followed instead his clear vision of a radical religion and did it so passionately that his own family thought he was out of his mind and were embarrassed. A truly religious life is never simply receptive. On the one hand, as the hymn we sang describes it, it is a battle to be fought and a race to be run. But on the other hand, no one can stay on the front line forever. So we have to have peace at times, periods of healing to make us strong again. And that side of the Christian religion is described by a Quaker poet in a famous hymn all of us have sung. One stanza reads, "Drop thy still dews of quietness till all our strivings cease. Take from our souls the strain and stress, and let our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace." But you notice what the lines take for granted? That our lives are not always orderly, and that strain and stress are a very definite part of them. No one knew this better than that poet, John Greenleaf Whittier, who was first of all a social reformer. In late life, when his generation viewed him as a famous poet, he wrote, "I set a higher value on my name as appended to the Anti-Slavery Declaration of 1833 than on the title page of any book." So you see, if you were looking for a chance to caricature Christianity as a drug for timid people, you could think of Whittier in mystical seclusion, writing pious and consoling verse, and you could say, "See?" But if you're interested in complete honesty, you must also look at him in Concord, going out to speak at an anti-slavery meeting, facing down a crowd on the way that pelted him with rotten eggs until his black Quaker hat ran yellow with the stains. Bitterly hated and lampooned for years in newspapers as a traitor. But religion has a kind of built-in doubleness, like most things. You've probably seen that little trick in which a coin with two colors or two faces can be spun so fast that a single color or face is what your eyes see. Well, spin those two faces of Whittier, and there is a perfect unity in which a man's courage and willingness to risk life and reputation for what he believes is perfectly balanced by those hours when he returns to the center of his heart's conviction to find healing and peace. He was proof of this unassailable fact. Genuinely religious people are not just sweet and harmless. In life and speech, they pronounce a judgment against the selfish and greedy world, and the world strikes back. But you cannot care deeply and still have constant peace of mind. Jesus wept. Remember when you were in Sunday school and you had to know the shortest verse in the Bible? That's it. Jesus wept. He was disappointed. He was depressed at times. He drove money-making entrepreneurs he considered to be thieves out of the temple with a whip. He called the religious leaders of his time hypocrites and rattlesnakes. They killed him for that. Not because he was sweet and harmless, or because his religion was a narcotic to make people happy in a harsh world. Happiness may come from religious conviction and peace of mind, but please remember something, only as byproducts and not as the main targets of our search. Modern pulpits talk a lot about personal adjustment. And much of that sounds to me like the bribery Karl Marx had in mind when he called religion the opiate of the people. Personal adjustment to what? New Testament Christianity was not very well adjusted to its environment. The gospel actually assumes that most social orders stand in need of judgment and that we should be opposed to them when they do. Be not conformed to this world, the greatest apostle wrote, but be transformed. Be changed across the grain of much of your world. A very dear lady leaves copies of Vogue and Mirabella on my desk for Billy to enjoy seeing what is fashionable. And I look at the ads sometimes, and the glittering, greedy life they promise, and the cost they require if you want that life. And I think that if you really bought into all that preoccupation with display and fashion, expense and vanity, a religion that talked of self-denial and cross-bearing would be absolute nonsense. I think it may be fashion and materialism and an inordinate love of luxury that we become addicted to, speaking of drugs, and then to make us feel comfortable about that lifestyle, we go for a religion that diminishes the majesty and challenge of God. You've heard it, that cozy notion of God as a friendly and harmless neighbor who lives in the apartment just above yours. Have you talked to the man upstairs? Somebody asks with a little smile. Call on him when you feel blue. He doesn't get upset over your little faults. He understands. I can remember when no less a theologian than film star Jane Russell reached the pinnacle of chummy religion when she described the Lord as a living doll. A great apostle, martyred later for his faith, might be so awed as to say, "Depart from me, O Lord, because in my life I miss the mark." But to Jane, the distance has disappeared. Religion is cuddly. The Lord is a living doll. In that kind of culture, no wonder religion verges on entertainment and often merges with it, with rock stars and bands, masters of ceremony, banners and gospel boogie, all playing to jam-packed crowds for whom the man upstairs, the living doll, is so squarely on our side that those who worship him would never dream that he might say, "For three transgressions of your society or of your life, yea, for four, I will not turn my wrath away." Intelligent faith knows that love of God cannot be separated from his judgment. The man upstairs is a silly idol built out of some childhood recollection of grandfather. The real God is the relentless one who pursues us and gives us no peace until we get it right. The hound of heaven of that famous 19th century poem. It is a fearful thing, Scripture says, to fall into the hands of the living God. Can you imagine the utter bewilderment of the person who wrote that? If that person could see the relaxed chattiness of much modern worship and hear the easy familiarity with which we address the eternal. I remind you of one more way in which religion can be an opiate. I refer to the chosen people syndrome, in which God belongs to our church, to our way of reading Scripture, to our racial or economic or national interests. I think I can praise the strengths of the American way of life as fervently as anyone, but we make no greater mistake than to think that our cause is always God's cause. We are often only nationalistic when we think we are religious, and we are always sectarian when we think our church is the only one through which the kingdom comes. And of course, when we think like that, religion is an opiate, a narcotic, a drug that suppresses honesty about how we have shaped our faith to meet our needs. A relative of mine in Western Oklahoma told me one day that although he had gone to church all his life, he had never been inspired by the music or challenged by the sermons. Not ever, I said. Not ever. He was what is called churched. Totally and faithfully churched. But the great passion of real religion had never touched him. He wasn't happy, and he wasn't warm and loving, but he was what every member of his church would describe as faithful. To be faithful, in that sense, to be called faithful, is to be damned with faint praise. Religion turned into a chore that was meant to be adventure. And please, mentally underline the word adventure. Someone helped me understand that word years ago. I had become fond of a man older than I, a Jewish man, who, because there was no synagogue, attended the Protestant church where I preached and where his wife was an active member. After a couple of years, this man went to the hospital, found he had cancer, and was told he had 2 months of life. You will understand when I say that it was hard for me to go see him, partly because I was so fond of him and I was not sure of my ability to keep emotional control, and partly because I had that common embarrassment and awkwardness about certain death that is so typical, especially in our society. But I went, and my hello, I think, was clumsy, and my first attempts at conversation, until my friend sensed what was going on. And then he said quietly, "But don't you see that it is still exciting?" My face hadn't caught on sufficiently. So he went on to say that he had been thinking about history and realized that all the truly great spirits were people who knew pain and the ultimate fear. And he pointed out that he had never known such things, that now he would face something new, and that in the process he would learn more about himself and about the meaning of life. And finally, he said, nothing has changed one iota. My basic conviction about life, that it is good when and only when it is seen and accepted as adventure. I thought that day, as I have ever since, that if religion is not first, last, and always adventure, it's hardly worth the effort. Not a routine, not a refuge, not a narcotic, but a great and endless adventure, forever curious, forever open to new insights. How can we hope to know God, who, if anything, is mystery, if we settle into safe and narrow ruts? If God calls us to Him, He calls us to explore, to enter the unknown, to share in the creation of a still unfolding universe. If God is mystery, we deny His very existence when we fail to be curious, given to growth, assuming that this and now are everything. A nice young lady decided in my office some days ago not to be married in this church, for fear that some of us might think, because she had asked me some questions and I had tried to answer them honestly. But she did not want to be married here, she thought, for fear that there were people in this church who might think the Bible was actually written by men named Jeremiah and John and Paul and Peter, or that evolution seems to be the way the mystery chose to unfold life on this earth. I don't want to be married in a church, she said, where somebody might think I came from a bug. Well, this pretty and pleasant young woman, I think, is afraid of scientists, afraid of textual critics, afraid of those who study comparative religion, afraid of new ideas, afraid of questions, fearful that what she has held to be religion up to now might be changed by somebody, and that before peace of mind could come back, there might be the pain and confusion of withdrawal. And there would be pain and confusion, of course, because they're part of what adventure brings. We can't even grow up without pain and bewilderment, as new emotions and new challenges make us over. And real religion means all of that. Adventure, growth, change, challenge. Next Sunday, I want to say more of what it means to say that religion is a call to adventure. And I hope you will come back.